You have an autobiography and history of Can't Heat out called Living the Blues. Unfortunately, it's almost completely sold out. Do you have plans to do another printing?
I haven't made that decision yet. The book has been very successful, and the last edition, the third edition, was finished, I guess, in more than 10 years ago already. So I have about 10 years of updating to do. If I decide to come up with a fourth edition, I will have to add all the adventures and facts of the past 10 years that are not on the book yet. So that means more work and all that. So I really don't know. I haven't made that decision. But if I find the time and the effort, the strength to do it, I will do it.
Sounds like a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. It took me 5 years to do the original book.
Wow.
And also the psychological changes, you know, the going through the interviews, you know, my co-writers were really the main force behind this book being made. They are professional journalists, and they pushed me into it. And part of the effort, you know, part of the ritual was to do those interviews and kind of going back to my life. It's like going through psychoanalysis again, you know, and living all those moments again. And some of those moments were quite sad and tragic, you know, and I, you know, it was hard to relive all that and put it on paper.
I see, definitely. Well, I wish you luck with that project, whatever you decide to do with it.
Yes, thank you. Have you read any of it?
Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to get a copy.
Okay, you know, in Google, if you go to Google and you enter the name of the book, they have an e-book, and they actually give you 3 chapters for free that you can read anytime.
Oh, on Google Books. I'll have to check that out.
On Google e-books. I was actually surprised that they are giving away 3 chapters for nothing. I guess to get people interested into buying the e-book, because that's really the only one that is available now, the e-book, and it's quite cheap. It's about $8 a shot, you know? And that one you can buy through Amazon or to Google. A paper version now, they are up to $200 each. They are considered a classic now. In Amazon.com, they are selling my books from $60, $75 for a used copy to over $200 for a new one.
Well, that speaks volumes about how good the book is.
It is good. It is very good. I'm very proud of it.
Let's talk about your musical career. You started drumming professionally in 1958, first with a Mexican band called Los Sparks, then with even more big-name bands in Mexico. Won't you please tell us more about your early career?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Some of the best times in my life, you know, with a lot of innocence and love for this American music that was coming in and just taking us, you know, taking over our lives, you know. Bill Haley and the Comets, Elvis, you know, Fats Domino, Little Richard, the purest, the feel, the real rock and roll that came out in the late 50s. We were just trying to copy and trying to be American rockers. And we did a pretty good job. Some of us, you know, were playing music all the time, and we dedicated our lives to play music. And I started around 13 years old. By the time I was 14 years old, I was lucky to have our first recording contract. So we were actually part of the Columbia CBS group in Mexico since I was 14 years old. I was recording for them. We did a couple of records in the late 50s, and then in the early 60s, I moved to other bands that were actually more popular than Sparks. I was in Los Hooligans, which was a very, very famous band all over Latin America and even in the U.S., and then another band called Los Sinners, which also was a very popular and high-quality band. With this band, Los Sinners, we actually decided to come to the U.S. and try our luck here. We always dreamed to come here where the birthplace of jazz music and swing and rock and roll was, you know, it was like a dream, as they call it now, the dreamers, you know, we were the original dreamers. And So we came to the U.S. and tried our luck, and we did quite well, with the exception that we were all underage. And, of course, we didn't have working papers. We came in with a tourist visa. So we didn't last too long. We lasted a few months here, playing in some famous clubs with some famous people, and did quite well until we got caught and we had to go back. We got caught and deported. You know, it was really fun. A bunch of 15 and 17-year-olds playing rock and roll, you know. It was a wonderful experience and gave me the first idea of what the situation about the rock and roll music scene was in the U.S.
Are any of those recordings still in print?
Oh, yes, they are. They are, and they are quite popular. They've been redone in CDs, and they are all basically in Mexico, but you find them sometimes in the U.S., in the Mexican-American areas.
In 1966, you moved to Los Angeles. You first joined the band Sotweed Factor and then Bluesberry Jam. How did that come about?
Oh, that was wonderful. Not only those two bands, but I played with some other people too, Larry Barnes and the Creations. This Sotweed Factor was, they were friends of some friends of my wife. I had just recently married. I married an American girl, which we were madly in love, and she helped me come to this country legally, you know. And I joined this band. They were like psychedelic guys, you know. There was the beginning of the psychedelic movement, and this was a band from Tucson. And it was a lot of fun, you know. We play, and we play at the Topanga Corral, which was one of the first hippie places in history, you know, in Los Angeles. There is people that say that the Topanga Corral was the first hippie joint before San Francisco. I don't know. That's arguable. But, yeah, that was the Sotweed Factor. Then I joined the Bluesberry Jam, and that was also a great band, a nice blues band. These were all nice American guys playing music. But, you know, as good as they were, I found myself, I'm not trying to brag here, but I had more experience than them. I know I had been in Mexico and all that, and you will think, well, Mexico, what kind of a scene is there? But if there was a scene, and also since I was already 14, 13 years old, by the time I came to the U.S., I was already almost 20, I had more experience than most of them. I had been in movies, I had been in TV shows, I had recorded already 4 or 5 LPs, so that really worked in my favor. And I was accepted and liked until Canned Heat came, which was my main thing, you know, my main thing in life.
How did you come to join Canned Heat in 1967?
Well, there was several ways that life or destiny linked me with Canned Heat. One of the first ones was when I met their original drummer, Frank Cook, in Mexico City. I let him sit in with my band, and then he invited me. You know, he told me, I'm part of the greatest blues band on earth. It's called the Canned Heat, and we're just getting together. It was the band was brand new. That was one of the first connections I did with him. Then also, I guess the word was out in the LA music scene that there was this drummer from Mexico, you know, that was very good, etc. And the Canned Heat band were having problems with their drummer. He was too much jazz-oriented, and they wanted someone that lay it down more on the rhythm and blues style. Their managers came to see me play at a little nightclub called the Tomcat Club in Torrance, California. And they liked the way I sang, and I played, and... And then they invited me to play a gig with Canned Heat, with my band, with Bluesberry Jam. And we actually did a gig together with the band, with Canned Heat. And we actually did better than they did. And that was because they had just been released from jail. I don't know if you know about the famous, infamous bust in Denver. And they were not really at their best. They had just been released in jail. They were having troubles with their drummer. And then this new band, Bluesberry Jam, really, you know, just played better than them that night. So that kind of, that made the managers very interested in me, not only to get rid of the competition of Bluesberry Jam and Salt Weed Factor, but also to get Canned Heat's another drummer. They invited me to an audition. And one of the things that got me into the band right in Bob Height's mind was that I showed up at the audition with a record under my arm that I had just bought from Chicago Blues, one of those Junior Wells Buddy Guy records, you know, from the South Side, Chicago. And Bob Height was a record collector and a musicologist, and Henry Vestine too, and Alan Wilson, to the three founding members. I didn't know how deep they were into the blues and how knowledgeable they were. But the thing they really liked is when I knocked the door and I opened that door and I had that record under my arm, you know, because it was kind of a signal, you know. Bob Height, years later, told me, I had already seen you play. I knew you played good. He said, but the fact that you had that blues record under your arm the day of the audition, that told me you were the drummer for Canned Heat. So I did the audition. I played. We played together. We played like one. We were like we had been playing for years. It was very nice. I knew all the songs. And then they came and asked me, do you want to join the band? And my answer was, I was born to play with Canned Heat. So that show of commitment and love and all that got me into the band.
That's quite a story. How did Johnny Otis come to engineer and produce Canned Heat's very first album in 1966?
Well, Johnny Otis was always a rhythm and blues icon. I mean, he's one of the most important people in that era. You know, he had his radio show along Wolfman Jack and Huggy Boy were the three rhythm and blues shows of Los Angeles. And he got interested in the band. I was not in the band yet when that record was made. I was still made with Frank Cook, probably in 1966. So, yeah, late 66 or early 67. I guess Johnny just liked the band. And I don't know how the connection came for him to produce the very first record the band made. And that record has been released and re-released and pirated so many times. There is actually, I think, one of the best-selling records of the band because there are so many versions of it. But, of course, we never got a penny from it, and I don't think Johnny got anything either. So it's been mainly the pirates that made all those copies, you know, and CDs, and they changed the title of it, and they changed the pictures and all that, but it's always the same session.
It's too bad that you didn't get compensated for it.
Well, you know, that's part of the history of music, you know. I mean, there's very rarely, you'll never meet a musician that has gotten paid for everything he has done, you know. Some of the companies or some of the, it's the nature of the business, unfortunately.
Your first live gig with Canned Heat was on December 1st, 1967. Canned Heat shared top billing with The Doors at the Long Beach Auditorium. Would you please tell us more about that show?
Well, I was in heaven. You can imagine. I mean, here I am, an immigrant. I haven't been in the U.S. a year yet. My English is still not that good. And here I am already playing with Canned Heat, which is like Los Angeles, the Los Angeles blues band. And I'm playing together with The Doors, which is one of the main bands also coming up. You know, I mean, we were not really that famous yet. We didn't have hit records. And The Doors were just starting themselves. But you had the feeling that a movement in music was happening. There was something going on. This is something that my manager, Skip Taylor, said to me at the door of the Tomcat Club, you know, because I'm playing in this rhythm and blues club wearing suit and ties and mainly backing black artists, you know, in this club in Torrance. And this is before my audition to Canned Heat. Skip comes to me and tells me, you know, there is something going on. There is something in music going on that is about to explode. And he says, do you know about a guy called Jimi Hendrix? and do you know about this and that, the Doors, etc. And you know, I didn't really know that much about them. It was the beginning, and the gig, that first gig with the Doors and the Canned Heat, it was my first experience with this renaissance in music that was happening in the late 60s. It was wonderful.
What was it like working with Bob the Bear Hite?
Well, as I said, Bob was a musicologist, and he had a passion for music and a passion for teaching. There was never-ending sessions of record playing in his house. The Bear's house was basically a house full of records. Every wall on his living room was full of records. I guess he got up to 100,000 78s and 45s and LPs, but mainly 78s. That was basically what he used to collect the most. And it was like a school. It was like a school of blues. And it was just wonderful. But Bob was kind. He Bob was related to that music and that love for music and his eagerness to teach people music. And that's part of our mission in life, which we did accomplish very well, which it was to make blues music palatable for white audiences and make blues recognized worldwide as a true American art form similar to jazz. And Bob Hite was really the locomotive that started all that. And of course, there is another side of him. There was the guy that loved to party. There was a lot of grass smoking on his record sessions. Of course, he would play a record and roll a joint and then play a couple of more records and then roll another joint. and he will have like this shoebox full of grass, and he will be always cleaning and rolling. And then he also had a big pot of chili. The Bear used to make some of the funkiest chili you can imagine. He would put just about everything that was in the kitchen there at the time, right? Beans, meat, whatever. He will heat it up and have it there for everybody. So those were the sessions in Bob Hite's house. It was smoking some weed, appreciating music, and eating chili. It was like, it was wonderful for us. I mean, we were in our 20s, and we were getting all this education from a guy that loved to party and loved to show blues music. And that was the continuation of his life throughout the years. Unfortunately, he had a very tragic life later on towards the end of his life. Poor Bob, you know, just got caught in alcoholism and drug addiction. He had a terrible marriage, and he was broke. And it was just a very sad downfall of this guy that would have been, if he was alive now, he would have been recognized as the grandfather of the blues or something like that, you know. It is a shame that he let go and got caught living the life, as he used to call it, you know, living the blues.
Alan Blind Owl Wilson was an amazing harmonica player and slide guitarist. While recording Hooker and Heat in 1970, John Lee Hooker remarked that Alan played Hooker's music better than he himself did. What was Alan like to work with?
Well, Alan was almost the opposite of Bob, but also with the same love for music and love for teaching as Bob had. Alan, of course, was the most talented of us and the most knowledgeable in music. He originally played the trombone. He read music very well. He knew history of blues. He had done tours around the South and was a contributing factor on the renaissance and recognition of Skip James and mainly Skip James and Son House, okay? And not only that, but when they rescued Son House from the hospital, he was suffering from alcoholism and old age. Alan actually sat down with Son House and showed him how to play his own music that he had forgotten, so he could present himself at the Newport Festival, the Newport Blues Festival, I guess a famous blues festival that happened, I believe, in 66, around that time. And Songhouse was able to present himself and play his music thanks to Alan Wilson sitting down with him and teaching him his own music again. As far as a person, Alan was a soft, wonderful person, very intellectual. He will be recognized as a nerd now, you know. We didn't use the word nerd in those times. And with the thick glasses, he was not very clean. He was kind of a funky individual, you know. He didn't care about personal hygiene. And all those worldly things didn't matter to him. He was into his studies. He studied botany. He used to learn the names of every leaf and every flower and every tree on earth. That was one of his challenges. He used to collect all kinds of leaves and pine cones and stuff and put them on his suitcases. You can imagine all the trouble we used to get crossing borders in Europe and all that with this guy, this funky guy that stinks and he's got mud in his shoes all the time and all that. And he's carrying all these strange green plants and pine cones and all that in his suitcase. It was funny. Alan was a wonderful person and a wonderful influence on blues music worldwide and on K&M Heat. Again, Alan, unfortunately, was, I believe he was mentally ill. He might have been bipolar, or I don't know how you to the diagnose what happened to him, but he became very, very depressed. It was he had problems with picking up women. I mean, here we are in a rock band, famous, with lots of groupies, all of us, and Alan cannot even get one woman interested in him because of his, I guess because of his hygiene and the way he's presented himself, because he was actually not that ugly of a guy. He was not an ugly guy. And he was very interesting, but I guess the groupies in the era didn't care about a guy like him. That hurt him, and most of all, when he became an environmentalist. You must remember Alan and the K&M Heat Band was one of the first bands that were militant environmentalists on the era. In those times, to be an environmentalist, to care about Mother Earth, and those values were considered anti-American, were considered communist. It was really a lot of pressure. And Alan was very much concerned about the condition of the earth. And he thought we had no hope. He thought we were going down fast. And the way I see it, he might have been right, because look at the situation right now, you know, the contamination and the corporate control of most of our lives and the killing of all the wildlife and animals. All that was really destroying Alan Wilson and contributing to his depression. And that was part of the reason why he tried to kill himself, and he eventually accomplished that.
I remember that. That was sad.
It was very sad and very tragic for us, and tragic for K&M Heat, and tragic for the blues world in general. And another thing I didn't mention is that he was the greatest harmonica player, period, you know, and that John Lee Hooker also confirmed it. He called Alan Wilson the greatest harmonica player ever.
What was it like playing with a legend like John Lee Hooker?
Well, playing with John was a wonderful experience, and the way we met him and everything, you know, we were in at the Portland airport picking up our luggage to play a gig, and then we see this black guy picking up an old Epiphone guitar, you know, from the carousel where the luggage comes, and we recognize him, saying, "My God, that's John Lee Hooker!" So we just ran towards him and wanted to shake his hand and introduce ourselves. And this time we were the groupies, you know. We just love John's music. I already was familiar with John's music since Mexico City when I got turned on to the blues, you know. And Bob and Alan, of course, they knew everything John had done. So we go to John and we introduced ourselves, and he actually was aware of our music too, because our music is very much influenced by John Lee's music. So we introduce ourselves with him, and he goes, okay. And he says, I know you. I like the way you voice Boogie. And then, you know, we started a wonderful relationship, and culminating with a concert in the Carnegie Hall and several tours, and that famous classic record called Hooker and Heat. We did actually two Hooker and Heats, the original for Liberty, which is considered a classic, and then we also did a live record in the Fox Venice called Hooker and Heat Live. Playing with John was a great experience because it was the pure blues. I mean, here we are playing with a genius, an actual genius who made the rules for the blues and broke the rules on the blues. And that's what made him so abstract and special. Recording with him, of course, it was first or second takes. He would not play more than a couple of times one song, you know. If you guys don't get it the first one, then it's no good, he will say, you know. Then sometimes we would say, well, you know, we had a problem with the sound here. Can we please do it one more time, John? Just once more, okay? Let's take two takes. Okay, I'll get two takes, but if you cannot get it there, then that's it. He will tell the engineers or us. So that was the purity of playing with John Lee Hooker. Not rehearsing, not trying things forever or staying with one song all day in the studio the way most bands do. You played it. And if it is there the first time, it's good. If it's not, go to something else. That was John Lee Hooker. And that's how much purity in his music there is. I've always said that his music was so abstract. If John Lee Hooker was a painter, he would have been a Picasso.
I've never heard that analogy.
I said that before, yes. I put it on his... on one of the things I wrote about his after he died.
In 1968, Canned Heat cut a Christmas novelty record called The Chipmunk Song with Alvin and the Chipmunks. Can you tell us more about how that record came about?
That was really funny because we actually smoked some weed in that record, and Alvin and the Chipmunks were the total innocent thing, you know, was like for kids, you know. I guess they were Liberty artists. And that was the same record company that we were with, which don't exist now anymore, you know. And I don't know who came with the idea. We were doing some Christmas stuff. We did a Christmas blues and a couple of versions of Christmas blues, the song. And I don't remember, probably the manager, probably Skip Taylor or Bob Hyde, you know. They were the guys that liked the funny side of the band. They must have gotten in touch with him, you know, to bring the chipmunks and do the, you know, the special effects they do with the boys, you know. And we decided to do the chipmunk, the Christmas boogie, and have the chipmunks there, you know, talking to us and singing and playing the boogie with us. And that's what it's all about. It's called the Christmas boogie with the chipmunks. And there is a part where Bob is going, you know, which is obviously insinuating that he's taking a hit, and he goes, hey, why don't you try some of this? And then, you know, the boogie starts again, and then the chipmunks are going, oh yeah, I'm liking it, I'm boogieing, you know. So, you know, thinking about it, you know, in those times it was so illegal to do things like that, you know. It's amazing that now finally in our lifetime marijuana is not considered a bad drug, because it's really not. But in those times, you know, we actually put it in, you know, we put the, why don't you try some of this? And then the boogie, you know. It was a lot of fun.
I remember the song Reefer Blues from, well, you'll pardon me, a bootleg of Canned Heat from, I guess, 1970.
Yeah, Reefer Blues is one of the last songs we did before Alan died. So that bootleg is actually comes from my tape. I had one of those little Sony two-track reel-to-reel tapes, and I happened to take my tape player to the rehearsal that night. I think that was the last rehearsal we did with Alan before he did his first attempt to kill himself. I remember we recorded a few songs there, and we were doing quite well, and Reefer Blues was one of them.
Yeah, there was a 17-minute version of So Sad on that record too. It was on the Atlanta label.
Yeah, I don't know about that one, but I know that Reefer Blues and all the other songs I recorded on that reel-to-reel, on that rehearsal, are in a CD entitled Ties That Bind. And I don't know if it is out in the market, but you can find that CD in our website. We still have copies of it that I've made. That CD has sessions that we did for Atlantic, produced by Tom Dowd, and also four songs out of my reel-to-reel recording of that rehearsal.
Sounds like it's worth tracking down. I'll have to do that sometime.
Yeah, it's called Ties That Bind, and it has a, as I say, it has a session that we did for Atlantic and Criteria Studios in Florida, and those sessions, those records never came out. That was a session that Atlantic decided to can, but they gave us the right to release it later. So I found a few of the outtakes, etc., and put it together more or less, and released it in the 80s, in the late 80s or mid 90s, around then. And I released it as Ties That Bind, which is the names of one of the songs.
What inspired Canned Heat's anti-drug track, Amphetamine Annie?
Well, it was a true story. It was very early still, but we realized of how harmful methadrine was. I mean, look what has happened now with methamphetamine. I think is the most dangerous drug there is, you know, probably more dangerous than even heroin. And we were aware of what happened to this girl, Annie. Annie was a speed freak, and she actually existed, Amphetamine Annie, and she died just like the record says. And we were playing around with a song called "The Hunter" from Albert King, basically using the same pattern of "The Hunter," you know. And we were just playing around in the rehearsal, and so we decided, well, instead of singing the Hunter's lyrics, why don't we keep more or less the same style that Albert King established and change the lyrics and make it into a new song? And it came out as almost everything we did, almost as part of the improvisation, you know. That's part of the essence of playing blues music, to improvise, to get away from the stiffness of the current contemporary problem of music, you know, that is so stiff and so predictable, and so there is no room for improvisation. We were improvising all the time. And Bob Hyde started singing, "Oh, I tell you this story about this girl I know, and her name is Amphetamine Annie." And then it went on and on, and it became quite a classic. It was not a hit record, it was kind of an underground hit. It is actually the first anti-drug song ever recorded. It came out 2 weeks before The Pusher, which was another anti-drug song by Steppenwolf. So Amphetamine Annie was actually the first song. And later on, years later, President Ford gave us a mention and sent us a thank you letter and all that for recording that song. And they also included it in an LP, I guess, issued by the U.S. government called Good Vibrations, which had all the anti-drug songs that you can think of and good message songs.
Would you like to talk about Canned Heat's experience playing at Woodstock 1969?
Well, that is the question that I get asked the most, and that's one of the reasons why I made that book. The first chapter in my book covers the whole story from the beginning to the end, with detail. And there are several funny stories there, you know. It was quite a day. I cannot go on and tell you everything that happened with detail because it will take too long. But just to give you an idea, is we were going through changes then because we had just lost Henry Vestine. He had just got into a fight with Larry Taylor, the bass player, and he quit the band 3 days before Woodstock. We hired Harvey Mandel on the spot the same night that Henry didn't show up at the Fillmore West, and we played with him without rehearsal again and without even knowing each other that well. Then the following night, we play at the Fillmore East in New York. We played two nights there. And then the following day was the Woodstock Festival. So I was pretty exhausted, and I didn't really know what Woodstock was or what the hell with the festival. And I didn't want to go. I actually even tried to quit the band because I was so tired and I was so depressed about the fact that the original band had, you know, suffered its first pierce, you know. I was missing Henry, and we were not really at our best, and I didn't want to know about it, so I decided I don't want to go. My manager, Skip Taylor, found himself a duplicate of the key to my room. He opened my room, and he physically dragged me out of bed. You know, he physically made me get dressed, put my T-shirt and Levi's on, because that's how we perform. And he comes into my room and says, Theo, listen to the radio. This is going to be a great gig. There's people there. There are hundreds of thousands of people there. You know, this is going to be the biggest gig you ever made. And, you know, what the hell are you talking about? You know, I don't want to go. I'm tired. I haven't slept. So finally, he dragged me, convinced me, and physically dragged me out of the room. We made it to this airport in White Kills, New York. Waited there for about 6 hours. I remember I actually caught some sleep laying on the hangar, you know, in the floor on the pavement. I went to sleep on the pavement waiting for a helicopter to take us there. And this is a funny one. We see this helicopter and we see these people from the press, you know, running with their cameras on. And we run towards the helicopter too. One of the kids with the camera goes in, and then Bob Height, you know, the bear, the big bear, 300 pounds, goes to him and goes, where do you think you are going? And the kid with the camera goes, we are going there to report the news. So Bob grabs him and just drags him out of the helicopter and throws him out of the helicopter and tells him, no, going there to make the news. So the guys just couldn't fight us, you know. They see this bunch of rowdies coming into the helicopter, and the journalist just had to wait for another helicopter. That was funny. So we jump in the helicopter. We pretty much hijacked that helicopter to make it to Woodstock. And that's when I realized, when we were on the air coming into the festival and I saw that 500,000 people there, and that's when I realized, my God, this is going to be the biggest gig we ever played. And I was actually happy that they woke me up and dragged me out of that room to play this gig. And, you know, of course, I can go on and on and on and tell you about it more, but maybe you guys should read the first chapter of my book.
I will when the first chance I get.
It is for free now in Google ebook, so it's okay.
Hooker and Heat with John Lee Hooker was just the tip of a very large iceberg. You and Canned Heat have played with a who's who of the blues. Would you like to tell us a bit more about that?
Well, I mean, not only we play with them, but we contribute to their recognition. You must understand that in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a lot of blues-oriented music going on, but there's still some of these black guys had not been given the recognition they deserve. For example, when we met Albert Collins, I mean, we loved Albert Collins' style of music. And we happened to be playing in Houston, a big gig, you know, and probably in one of the big stadiums. And we looked for Albert Collins, and we found him advertised somewhere, or somebody told us, he's playing in a place called the Ponderosa Club. And we said, well, you know, let's look for him. We show up, and there is Albert, I mean, one of our idols, playing in a little place with 10 tables, and there was hardly, you know, 15 people there. And there he is, playing with a wonderful trio, with an organ, you know, and a drummer. And you know, we listened to his show, and then we went to him, and we told him, you know, we are the Canned Heat. We really would like to help you get the recognition you deserve. And we convinced him to come to the West Coast, to Los Angeles. We talked to the people on the on Liberty Records, which I believe had become already United Artists by the time. And we told them how much talent Albert Collins had and how they should sign him and help him get recognition in the white world. And that's what we did. We convinced Albert to come to the West Coast, and we got him signed with United Artists. And from then onwards, his career went up, and he became quite famous and recognized. So, you know, besides, as I mentioned Son House and Skip James, which were the original, you know, blues masters, and Bob Hyde, Henry, and Alan had a lot to do with their comeback in the Newport Festival. And we had a lot to do with John Lee Hooker getting recognition after the Hooker and Heat album. John's career totally changed and got a lot better and got very famous. And the same with Albert Collins. I mean, I also had the privilege and the honor to play and back T-Bone Walker a couple of times when he was coming to the Topanga Corral. I mentioned the Topanga Corral as the original blues or hippie joint in history. So it was still going on in the 70s and 80s. And I became kind of the house drummer of the Topanga Corral. And the corral used to have a lot of the great blues players come over there, like Big Joe Turner and Margie Evans and T-Bone Walker, whom I played with, all these people. It was quite an honor and privilege to play with them. And I used to make $25 a night playing those gigs, but it was just wonderful just to be with them and playing that music. And after all, we were making good music, good money with K&P Heat, so it didn't matter. Let me think. Some other people that I played with that I had a privilege to play with was at the Tomcat Club before I joined K&P Heat. And that was, for example, the Shirelles and the Platters and Etta James. Troy Walker, who was a white guy, but, you know, he was part of the country blues and blues scene, country music, I mean. And it was just great, you know. I'm trying to think of somebody else. George Harmonica Smith, too. That's another one that I play with in the chorale. And so that's about it. I mean, I had Silas Hogan. We met him in New Orleans and Baton Rouge. And I cannot think of anybody else, but maybe there were others.
What are K&P Heat's plans for the future?
Well, we are working. We've been working really hard. And, you know, we are almost in our 70s now. Larry Taylor is already over 70, and I'm going to turn 69 next month. I mean, in a couple of months. So I really never expected to be working at this age. I thought I was going to be retired already. My father used to make fun of me, used to say, "What, are you going to be playing drums with gray hair and being an old man?" And I can't believe it. We're still playing. We're getting a lot of recognition. We're actually making more money now than we ever did. And I guess we are considered legends now, and a lot of people our age and a lot of younger people to come to our concerts. So we're doing quite well, and we're playing live. We're doing an average of 3 European tours a year. We're working a lot in Canada, and we're playing a lot of festivals and gigs here in the United States too. So we actually have more gigs that we can handle and more gigs offered than we can actually physically make, you know, because we get tired of traveling. Traveling is really what kicks our ass now, you know. It's very hard and has changed a lot. The airline industry is horrible. The traveling industry in general is terrible, you know, and they are like almost act against their own customers, you know. And it's very different than in the past when traveling by air was a wonderful experience. You know, now it's really an exercise in tension and uptightness. You know, it's a very uptight situation. So that is really hard on us, the traveling and the moving around a lot. But we're still working a lot, and you can see in our site, if you go and look at our archives of all the gigs that we're playing, we're still playing an average of 70 gigs a year, sometimes more. And as I said, three European tours. We already have a planned European tour for March. We're playing Mexico. We already have two or three offers to play in Mexico and some American festivals. One thing that I want to mention is that we haven't recorded in a while, and we really don't intend to record anymore. But Thomas Roof, who runs the Roof label, is a blues label from Europe that is very well known. He offered us to record us and make a DVD of the band live, the band now, the actual Can't Hit Now live. And that's about it. That probably will be, well, maybe the last recording we will make. We are really not that interested in going into the studio because most of the music will eventually be pirated. We may not make any money on it, and it's really not worth putting all the effort and stress that it takes to make a good record, you know, to later on see it for free in YouTube and all these other internet channels and just be ripped off. And plus, we already have, I would say we have over 50 CDs. And there are two or three more that are about to be released from the band in the 60s, I mean in the 70s and the 80s. And like we are about to release a live in the Hilton Reno, which is a great CD. I'm very proud of it, and I just found it. And we're also releasing the live in Carnegie Hall with John Lee Hooker and another live in Boston. All these records that are going to be released next year. So that would make over 50 CDs that we have released. So we don't see really any reason why going back into the studio, besides the live DVD that we are going to make next year in Germany.
Mr. De La Parra, thank you for talking with me. Have a good holiday season.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.